How are you?
So you got here.
Oh, well, I am so sorry.
Hi, Jim.
Oh, no, no problem.
How are you?
Good.
That's what we really sorry. Just these topics.
All right. I'm sorry I'm late. We'll catch up. I want to welcome everybody here. And Emma, I think we do have a call, right? So that's great. Is there anyone that's not here that maybe we could just do a little roll call? Looks like
Steve's here.
So I missed you guys, by the way.
We missed you too.
Everyone's here except for Nuna,
yeah,
who is on vacation, as I understand it. So we're assisted by Emma. We really appreciate the work that she's doing, just kind of sitting into the support that I normally get from Nuna. She's giving me today, so really appreciate that. Today's meeting is scheduled to be an hour, and I think the main purpose of the meeting really is to get a vote for approval of the Pay for Success investor repayment. And then, hopefully, if we have a little bit of time, we'll be able to address a couple of other things that, if not, they'll be in future meetings. So, I think the first order of business is the minutes that have been distributed to everybody. Hopefully, you've had a chance to review them, if so, I'd entertain a motion.
I will make a motion to approve the August 28th.
A second.
Okay, having a first and a second, any discussion? If not, I'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you for that. We're pleased to have with us today Mark Innocenti, and who is here to kind of walk us through this year's 2018-2019 performance outcome with the Pay for Success cohort. And many of you may recall that in our last meeting that Mark provided kind of a historical view of this data to help provide a little bit of background and context, particularly for the new board members. And now he's going to share his annual review of this year. Following him, we'll hear from Debbie Corti, from financial manager of DWS, and she'll walk us through the amounts calculated as the investor repayments for each cohort. And she'll also provide information on the contract that is being developed for United Way for Salt Lake to issue payments to private investors. So let's proceed on that basis.
Before we jump into the Pay for Success data, you'll notice on the minute there was an action item that I had that was left to me in the right-hand column on there. Essentially, the basic finding from the school ready stuff, looking at the children that were going through the preschool program, was that although most students made statistically significant progress during the year, they improved on their developmental skills. Students in the funded group did not catch up to the comparison in terms of their PPP scores. And I was asked at the last meeting to break that down by program, and so I did a look in kind of of the five different sites. Really, three of them I couldn't really do break them down by programs, statistically speaking, because the sample sizes for both were too small, or they had everybody in the funded group and like one or two kids in the other group, and you really can't do an analysis when the data is so skewed like that. So really, I was only able to kind of really look at the Granite School District data, and then Smart Kids had sufficient numbers of kids to look at as well. I basically found the same outcome for the individual sites as I did for the entire region. So they did hold, and I can't say with any, you know, any of the authority about the other three given sample issues that they had. So just so you know how that came out. Now I did my part on that one.
Check that one.
So, see, good paying attention. Thanks to Amber for queuing. So just a quick overview of the paper success. You know, I did kind of present the history of it last time, and just so you have a feel again for what's going on. You know, we identify approximately 25% of the sample of children that were in the programs that were part of the paper success program sample. At pretest is going at or below 70 on the Pickett PPD picture vocabulary test. Again, it's a norm reference measure of receptive language skills. It's got strong predictive validity. It predicts later school outcomes pretty well as well. The 25%, it was usually a little less, but always between 20 and 25%. We're considered the high-risk group. Score of 70 puts them at the lowest third percentile and below of all kids in the U.S. that have taken the test. So it's two standard deviations below the mean. It's pretty significantly low score, really. The way the project was structured is that I was tasked with following these children through sixth grade. There is a payment schedule that I'll let somebody else talk a little bit more about, based on the number of children in the at-risk group that stay out of special education. The thought was that because they are such a high-risk group, without some intervention before they got into the schools, these children would all pretty much be in special ed. So they're very high risk for special education placement. So that's kind of where we were looking. The assumption was that preschool participation for this group will reduce later special education placement. That was kind of the bottom line assumption. So right now, we're at history at this point. 5 cohorts of students have received preschool service. All the cohorts are in elementary school at this point. So there's nobody's in preschool anymore. And so we're doing the overtime following. Thanks to the folks at USPE for helping provide data. John helped quite a bit, and so that was very nice. They own the data set, so they have to. this is kind of the big picture in a glance here. Let me orient you to this table. So basically the top part is really, along the top you can see the different cohorts. Cohort 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 corresponds to their grade in school. Cohort 1 is in the fourth graders primarily now. There's a few kids who aren't quite in fourth, but overall, most of them, let's say the vast majority in all these cohorts are in the identified grade. So cohort 1's fourth, third, second, first. Cohort 5, which is our most recent, they just finished kindergarten last year. The number in cohort was the number we reported on at the end of the preschool years. That was the number we reported on. The next category is unable to find. You know, we do lose children every year. You know, it's just kind of the nature of the system in some ways. Typically, you're going to have some attrition. Children, you know, other things can happen. Children can move out of state. They could move to a new school district. And although I think the system's getting a lot better at tracking kids over time, their ID number, some cases, has changed. Some of those kids we've been able to track. Some of them we haven't been over time. But we do lose kids over time, year to year, essentially. So the total found is actually the total number of kids, total number of students that we were able to identify and that are in the state database that we have information on. So it's a little less than the original number in the cohort in all cases. A couple asterisks in there. In cohort number 4, we had 665. Actually, 5 of those kids were from the at-risk group. Five of those kids from the 665 were actually in cohort 3, but they weren't old enough. The programs had identified them inappropriately at their entrance date for school, so they ended up with another year in preschool. So we moved them into cohort 4. kind of made sense that they'd be in with the cohort leaving that year into the school. The double asterisk on the 29 is that when I went back and reviewed the data we had from the 641, five of those children were identified for preschool special ed during the preschool year. And the rule is that if you're identified for preschool special ed during your preschool year, you are removed from the follow-up cohort. So we don't follow up anybody that gets special ed while they are in preschool. And so I had to take those five kids out, so you know what's going on with that. And I put in the number from the at-risk group so you can kind of see what's going on with that.
Mark, are there the students that we aren't able to find, are they included in the percentages there?
They are not.
Okay.
They're pulled out of everything at this point. And so, so like the number, the non-risk and number of the risk group will equal the total amount.
Okay.
And so, so the next rows are the non-risk group. I put that in there just so you can kind of see what's happening to those children. They were all above 70 to begin with, so you can kind of see the history of that. We do have, we always have more kids than that by far. You know, it's a 75 to 80% will be in that. The way it works, the non-risk group, the number in special ed is the number of kids that are receiving, that have been identified for special education services during this current year, the past year, so it would be the 18-19 academic year. Then just a percentage of non-risk kids in special ed. So you can kind of see how it's going. The next set of rows is the risk group kids. So the number of kids that are in the high-risk group, the number of that group that's in special education at this point. The payout group, then it's just a subtraction process. So the number that are not in special ed at this point. And then it's the percentage of children in the at-risk group in special education. So you can get a... can see what's going on right there.
Sort of a request for future presentations. Would it be possible to do the number and assignment rate for the non-risk group and the at-risk group combined? And the reason I'm requesting this is because this is material in the public record.
Uh-huh.
And it's entirely possible that if independent people who are not familiar with the analysis, they may misinterpret some of these numbers.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important. So I just did for cohort 1 in 4th grade, and if you combined it, it's about a 15% overall assignment rate, which I haven't looked at the low-income, the free and reduced lunch special education assignment rates recently, but I believe that that's better than the historical rates anyway. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's important information to have out there, that in fact preschool is reducing the special education assignment rates for this economically disadvantaged group.
Can I just make a request? For those of us who don't speak that language, can you translate that for us?
Sure. Sure. So,
I think if you translated, I might understand
it. Oh, absolutely. So what we have now is we've separated out children who scored 70 and above and children who scored 70 and below.
Right.
And we would expect the 70 and below number to be higher, mm-hmm. right? And that's not unusual.
In special ed.
In special
yeah.
ed, the percentage in
right.
special ed. However, if somebody is not familiar with what we're doing, they may say, oh my God, kids in preschool have a 21% special education assignment rate. Preschool isn't working. And that would be a misinterpretation of this data. And so because it's all the kids in preschool, these are all low-income kids,
right.
free and reduced kids. And so if anybody outside of this group who doesn't understand what we're doing, they may misinterpret what this information is saying. And by presenting the number for all kids in preschool that receive the PPBT, it provides information in the public domain that's more aligned with what other groups and people outside of this group would see. And they could then, if they wanted to take a look at what is the efficacy of preschool in reducing special education assignment in grade school, they have a number that they compare to a like number in the public database or what USB reports in terms of how many children and what percentage of children who are qualified for free or reduced lunch are in special ed. So it just provides more information about preschool in general, not so much about the payout group and the non-risk kids, but it provides a more robust picture of what's happening, of the impact of preschool on whether or not children need later special education.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead, Joe.
Mark, it's notable to me the improvement or the trend in from cohort to cohort, really for both groups. 13 to 2.9, 21 to 3.2. Is the reason for that just improvement in over time in the program? Have we really tried to determine the reason for these improving numbers?
Let me show you the next data set because I'll take you through cohort one through all their years. You can kind of see how it progresses over time, and I think that will help with your question. Just to kind of piggyback on Janet's comment, I think there is a concern with the public getting this data as well, and that I don't think that everybody understands that the non-risk group, by most counts, is a risk group as well. And so they are low-income kids. They're all eligible for free and reduced lunch. So right away, so like even if you look at the total number, which would be higher, our data people for UBOE can understand it, but I think on average, the average in the population is about 10% of kids get into special ed.
Should we alter the terminology?
That wouldn't be a bad idea.
Instead of saying non-risk, say lower risk, higher risk? I don't know.
They're the same.
They're all the same,
but they're demographic. Some of them are receiving something.
Yeah, well, some of them are... Some of the risk group are at higher risk.
But the difference between these categories is that the non-risk kids entered the pre-K program and scored 70 or higher on the PBBT. Am I correct?
You're correct.
So those kids are arguably ready for preschool potentially, and the other kids are not. So that's really the comparison.
Not really. You wouldn't say that they're ready for, because if you have a PPBT score of say it's 85, which is one standard deviation behind the mean, children who score at that level are still going to encounter some trouble in school. So it's not that they'll walk into school and do fine within the 80% of 75 to 80% of kids that are not in the high risk group. There's a lot of variability in their scores and. Very few of them go above 100, so there's very few that go right on the average mark. Almost everybody falls on the below 100 range. We only have a few kids every cohort, get above 100, but they're rare. So there's still high risk for that group. So I can take a shot at kind of renaming them. That way I'll remember. That's good. So, kind of get to your question, Jim. So, here's cohort one across all years. They started in the 14-15 school year, now they're up to the 18-19 school year. You can see, if you look at the total found row, over time we've been losing more kids. People move. They change, and so the number goes down from year to year a little bit. If you look at the percentages in special ed, we see an increase both for the non-risk and special ed group and for the at-risk and special ed group, and it's kind of consistent with what we know about special education placement. It becomes more likely as children approach third and fourth grade, and it's a little less likely in the earlier grades.
I think if it holds true with the general student population, that those numbers will actually start going down after third, fourth grade, because usually students are more likely to be identified about the third grade.
Yeah. It would remain consistent after a certain point. Getting out of special ed is harder than getting out of jail, really. It's really a challenge.
That's true.
The research on it shows that once you're labeled special ed, it's hard to lose the label. Yeah. And so,
that's a good point.
So we would see at some point, considering the fourth grade, you know, we might see a little more increase, but at some point they're gonna, it's gonna max and level out. Now, that's what you would expect anyway.
Why they don't like to label them people that third grade.
Yeah. Gives them a chance to.
Right.
And then, you know, in the way the law is written, you are not supposed to label people based on kind of environmental causes all by themselves. So it has to, you know, but at some point, they start to fall behind in academic skills and they get identified.
Well, do you have some way to understand, you know, those that may have learning disabilities or other, you know, that aside just from really being behind or language, you know, really belong in special?
Not really. You know, we don't have much data more than the PPVT scores, really. You know, in some cases, with some of the years, we do have some. We did give a readiness test and looked at the, kind of their readiness for kindergarten. And so for some of the kids, we could go back and look at that, where they stood on that. That might be an interesting side project I could get somebody involved in.
Well, and it's really hard to identify students, kindergarten, first grade students for special ed or even refer because you don't have data.
What you see is the ones who are being picked up are being, you know, usually the more severe cases, like in preschool.
Sure.
Something is triggering off the alarm for the teacher that the teacher makes the referral. I don't know exactly what that is. So that's kind of the pattern. I think this is the pattern. You can see it most clearly with this because this is cohort one for, you know, across 5 years now. And so, so you really can kind of see what's going on. The numbers are going up for both groups much more quickly for the at-risk group, but still a fair number. You know, almost 80%, 79% are pretty much maintaining out of special ed, so staying out of special ed. So we'll see how that goes over time. And then I just did the same thing with the other cohorts, just so you could kind of see what was going on if you want to take a look at your data. The pattern remains essentially the same over the years. Now we see the increases, they're moving into third grade. We'll see what happens for our next year, but the patterns remain the same. And that's also, I did cohort 3 and 4, again, so you can kind of look and kind of see what's going on with that. But the patterns are consistent, really. It doesn't change by cohort. You kind of see what's going on with the kids at different times. And how the increases go on. And under investor repayment.
I'm going to keep it nice and simple. So Mark went over the actual amount of students that were left. So cohort one, we actually do not pay out for. That was kind of the trial one that Salt Lake County, proof of concept that Salt Lake County and did. So we only pay out on cohorts 2, 3, 4, and 5. So based on that calculation of 96 in cohort two, the payment is $240,611.20. So how we calculate this, just so you have, so you know, is that we take those 96 students and we times it by the weighted pupil unit that was determined for the school year that they started and stuff. So that number stays consistent from the year to year and stuff. And then that's times by 95% that is we're paying back. So it's the 95% that we're paying back and stuff. So that's how we get to that number. So cohort two is based on 96 students. Cohort 3 is based off of 94 students. Cohort 4 is off of the 115 students. And cohort 5 is off of the 112. So for this year, it will be a total of $1.2 million. Any questions on that?
Do you know how that compares to what was estimated in the original bill?
I do. We would have that. I would just need to grab my computer.
I
successful who about $60,000 to $80,000 less than that. So.
Knew we had it, just had to go and get it real quick. Yeah. So that's how the calculation is done. And so that is the amount that we'll be paying out. So I will have invoices for Jim to sign afterwards with you guys' approval of that. Just wanted to touch back on how we pay this out. So how this is paid out is we send a check to, or we send the money to United Way, and United Way then distributes it out to Goldman Sachs and our contract with United Way was actually under with GoEd, which is not DWS, and so when the board moved over, we've actually been working with them to get a new contract out. We didn't realize that we needed to have a new contract out with them. So where we're at with that, just so the board knows, so hopefully you'll approve this payment today, but unfortunately we will not be able to make the payment today because that contract's not in place. But we have been out with Safe Purchasing to do a sole source so that we don't have to go out for RFP on to make these payments since it's all already set up. They have told us that that should be approved by the 17th of this month. We have a scope of work out to United Way listing out what their duties will be, and we're hopefully by the 17th as well that we'll get it back from them and be able to put the contract out, and hopefully that day, pending your approval of that, then we'll be able to get that signed and get that payment made to them.
So my understanding then is that today we'll need to approve the amounts that you've got here. But we're going to wait until the next board meeting to approve the contract.
I think what we're going to hopefully do is hopefully have an emergency electronic meeting once we have the contract ready for approval so that we don't have to wait all the way till the next meeting to get that payment
so
out.
We need to let everybody know that there'll be some kind of interim communication for either a verbal or email vote on the contract, and then I think there's also another vote that's needed to give authority to me to basically sign the contract.
Yes, I think that we can actually do today.
Okay.
Is that we can give the board can give you the authority to sign the contract on behalf of the board, and that way when the board does approve the contract, then you already are in position to sign it.
And about when do you think that's going to occur?
So I'm really hoping that the 17th, when we hear back from State Purchasing, that we'll have worked everything out with United Way so that within 2 to 3 days of that, we'll have a contract ready to be executed and signed.
So that's
so
next week.
That's like next week, yes.
So everyone should.
We were really trying to hopefully get to done by today. Unfortunately, we're not quite there. So there's been some hard work by Noon and Emma and Tracy and our contract analyst team to get this done and stuff. So I really appreciate all their hard work on that. So we're close. I do have a copy of the scope of work that we have provided for United Way. It is very similar to what is in the old contract that we had with them, just scaled down to not be the intermediary to make the cohort investments, that kind of thing. It's just to facilitate the repayment now of the established cohorts.
So really, there are two issues then that we need to address, action items. The first is to approve the amount.
Correct.
And the second is to approve giving the authority to sign the contract when it is approved.
Correct.
Which will be in within the next week.
Hopefully, yes.
I think we can put that in the same motion.
Does that sound all right to you?
I think we should keep them separate.
Separate the two?
Let's keep them separate.
Okay.
So are there any questions on the amounts in the presentation by Debbie? No, I'll entertain a motion for that one.
I'll make a motion that School Readiness Board approved the payments to the investors for cohorts 2 through 5 as presented by the Department of Workforce Services for school year 2018-2019.
Having a motion made and a first and a second, is there any discussion?
I'm not suggesting we amend it yet, but do we want to include language to the effect that this is pending approval of the contract, that these payments are made until the contract's approved?
You're approving the amount that we will pay out, right. Not necessarily the methodology of how that gets paid out.
I know. I'm thinking ahead to our next motion, which is going to authorize us to sign the approval. We don't have a contract yet, so maybe we should put language in there pending the approval of the contract or contingent on approval of the contract.
Okay, so it's been suggested then that we modify that to condition upon the signing of the contract.
That's a friendly amendment.
Yes. Okay, we've had a motion, an amendment. Can we have a second to the amendment?
Okay.
Any other discussion? I'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, thank you. One last action item, and that is that of giving me authority to sign the contract once it's approved, which will be in the amount.
Will it be approved by a quorum or unanimously throughout all of the members?
You mean the contract?
Yeah, that contract, yes.
Well, it'll require a quorum.
Okay.
I mean, but we're going to be doing that remotely because of the timing that we're talking about here, so
okay.
That's assuming we get everybody together and have a call.
Yeah, and I guess I'm a little bit concerned about our ability to get together next week for a quorum, and I'm just wondering if there's a way to talk about the general confines of the contract as it exists, and then grant you with the authority to review it and sign it on behalf of the board. Unless that feels like too much authority to give.
I would like to know how many are not available next week.
There are several days I'm not.
So at least two of you.
Even electronically, if we.
Well, I mean, I have several days that it would be challenging for me to get out there the first 2 days.
Oh, I meant electronically.
Oh, electronically.
This is electronically. It's not a meeting like this.
So the 17th is a week from today, which is a Thursday. The chances of us actually getting it all executed would probably take at least 1 to 2 days. So it would actually probably be the week after that.
Okay.
So it would probably be the 21st through the 24th. Yeah, through the 25th. So that week. Not necessarily next week, which I know is UEA. So for many.
Yeah, I'll be out of town that week, but I'm always connected. So I'm sure I can, either via call or email. I don't know how the others feel. That week.
No, next week's meeting.
Yeah,
UEA.
It's after UEA.
It's week after UEA.
And I think in with the Open and Public Meetings Act, if this body is considering something, reviewing it, we have to kind of conduct a phone meeting.
Yes.
We can't just do it by email to the members.
I am more than happy to talk about the details of the contract if that's how the board would like to go as well, how it stands
and
currently.
Yeah, I mean, if we did that and everybody felt comfortable with the details of the contract, then it's just pending to get approved, I guess, by legal.
Correct.
And then...
Without any significant changes, yes.
Without any significant changes, and then... If everybody feels fine with me then signing on behalf of this board, then, and we don't have any changes, then I suppose we could not have to have that call. I don't know how that feels to everybody. I want to make sure you're...
What's the probability of it being approved without significant changes?
From the Department of Workforce Services standards, this is how we would actually, this is exactly how it would be. It's really truly pending what United Way comes back with if they have significant changes and stuff.
Oh, you know they are, though.
Well, has it already been negotiated with United Way?
It is currently with United Way for their review.
So
that's where it currently is.
Have it through their side yet.
Well...
We kind of do.
Oh.
So,
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah.
Do you want to introduce yourself for purposes of
sure.
people who are on the phone?
Hi, I'm Bill, and the CEO of United Way of South Lake. And I haven't seen the contract language specifically, the actual contract, but Amy walked me through the general structure of it and the agreements, and I felt comfortable with that and came today to answer any questions, if there were any. And so I'm, again, I haven't seen it to sign it, but based on the conversations that Amy and Debbie and others have had, we're comfortable with it. Sounds great.
Does someone else want to sign this contract?
I think we have people in both of our legal departments reviewing it. And if I can just speak just with historic knowledge of the first contract and then this one, the biggest difference is that under the earlier contract for United Way as the intermediary, there was a lot of activity that they had to do in backfilling any student movement. So if students kind of are moved out of a program, they had to backfill another student to go in the cohort. So they had to make sure that there were the right number of students, and then Mark had to go administer the PPVT. So under the old contract in the program intermediary, they were doing a lot of administrative tasks, and the school readiness board was paying approximately $60,000 a year for them to do those tasks. Because the legislation changed so dramatically and there's no more cohorts, we only did the six, now it's just a question of for us to determine the repayment and for the United Way to act as the intermediary with the investors, because they're the ones who have the agreement with the investors. So there's things on there like we have to make a decision on the cohort payout within a certain number of days, by August 31st mm-hmm. every year, which means Mark's work has to be done before that, which means USBE has to give them the data before that. But in terms of the actual activities that United Way is doing, it's largely, correct me if I'm wrong, to make sure that the investors get those payments in the time at which they're legally obligated to receive those payments. So the language in the contract really ensures that their commitments to the investors is reflected in this agreement. Timelines are as they should be, and all of those other activities have been taken out of the agreement because they don't have to do that anymore. So that's like super high level summary of what it looks like without getting into the legal jargon about it.
And I would just add that we actually talked about taking United Way out of the middle of this, because if we were redesigning everything right now, we wouldn't be necessary. The reason not to do that is it would be enormously expensive to redo the contracts between the investors and DWS directly. So for no money, we can stay in the middle, and all we're doing is fulfilling our contractual obligation to the investors of getting them the remaining funds. We don't have any other intermediary functions to perform. There's no cost associated with that. But it does save the state and the investors money to leave us in the repayment role, so you don't have to negotiate the contract.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's more simple this year.
And that's generally what the contract
yes.
outlines are.
Yes, that's exactly how it currently is outlined, yes.
Okay. Well, I propose that we go ahead and approve the amounts. Did we approve the amounts?
We've already done that.
We've done that. And that we approve me to sign the contract as we understand it, and it's been explained to us. And if there are deviations from the contract, then we would come back to the group. And at that point in time, we need to discuss the contract as well as my employee. I'm not going to sign it until, this group is comfortable with it. And I understand you're comfortable with it, with what you understand, if there aren't changes to it.
We're not anticipating any significant changes.
Well, I'll take a stab at a motion.
Good.
I make a motion that we authorize Board Chair Jim Sorensen to sign the contract on behalf of the School Readiness Board, absent any material changes to the proposed contract as described in this meeting.
I'll second. Any discussion? Call for a vote then. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
I'll have you sign those invoices afterwards, after the meeting.
Okay, great. The next item is we've all been sent draft administrative rules that were updated based on the responsibilities of the newly assigned board members in the SB 166 during the 2019 legislative session. And we need to essentially have a vote of approval to go ahead and enrolling these for public comment, which would be the next step in adopting these rules. So are there any comments or questions regarding the administrative rules that anyone would like to bring forward? If not, then I'd call for a motion. Or no, excuse me. We do need a. Do we need a motion for this one?
Yeah.
And I'd call for a motion to accept these administrative rules. I think the next step is public comment, and then for adoption.
I'll make a motion.
Okay. Is there...
Do we have copies of these rules? Hey, thanks.
I'll second it.
Any comments? Questions? If no, I'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Now, we've got about 15 minutes, Emma. Do you think we've got enough time for the research subcommittee update?
I do. I think I chatted with John this morning, and he said that it's going to be a brief update, so I think we have time.
So this was really introduced. John was introduced at our last meeting. He's a researcher, state board, focused on school readiness, and he's here to share his research questions and talk a little, give us kind of an update on the research committee.
Okay. So yeah, I do. My name is John Collins. I do work at the State Board of Education. So just briefly, the background of this research subcommittee. In April of 2019, a different group, the Quality Tool Work Group, recommend the creation of this research subcommittee to further assess the appropriate quality tool or tools for assessing high quality in a preschool program and develop a school readiness initiative research plan. So basically the three tasks were, as mentioned, the develop the school readiness initiative research plan, assess the appropriate quality tools, and develop a recommendation for the school readiness board, and develop a recommendation on student performance outcome thresholds to establish for the 2020-2021 school year and the expanded student access grant. So those were the three tasks given to the subcommittee. I'm basically here today to talk about one, the initiative research plan. So we met once. The group includes, I think, all people in this room. Jimmy Hernandez back there, another researcher at the State Board of Education, Jamie Robinson, Jessica Smith, Janice joined us online, and Mark Innocenti all participated in this group. And this is sort of what we came up with our initial meeting. So the overarching question, I guess, obviously, is does being in preschool better prepare children for kindergarten? That's basically what we're getting. Oh, sorry, and Emma, I did mention you, is also in the group. So does being in preschool better prepare children for kindergarten? That's essentially where we're coming from. And the three kind of main sub-questions to that, does high-quality designation relate to student outcomes? What skills do students need prior to K-entry? There's some discussion of whether we're just going to follow what the kindergarten entry exit profile outlines or whether we're going to develop our own skills that we're looking at, and can we use two different tools to assess program quality, so essentially the class assessment tool and the Eckers 3 assessment tool. So we will, in order to answer these questions, be looking at the number of students leaving preschool and entering kindergarten who are considered proficient. For that, we will plan on using the PEEP exit and the KEEP entry. Proficient is scoring a proficiency level of 3. Disaggregating those outcomes by student group and dosage. So we'll look at income level, ethnic group, things like that. And we're looking at the overlap of the class and Eckers 3 tools. So part of that is a literature study. There's been work done on this already. A few places like Arkansas have already looked at the overlap between those two tools. And doing our own, Jessica and Emma, to some degree, are going to be able to go out and assess programs simultaneous to another with those tools, so we can gather some of our own information. Essentially what we're looking at is whether or not those two work well together. There are some reasons that class works better in a public setting. Yeah, public setting and Eckers 3 works better in a private setting, which is why we may continue to co-use those tools, just for practical reasons as much as anything else. Those are essentially what we're looking at. I was trying to keep it brief, and I went quickly. Are there any questions or concerns to what I've kind of mentioned here?
The only question I have, and keep in mind that I'm not I don't have quite the understanding you do, but it'd be great to have kind of a short definition of these acronyms and how they work. Keep class, Eckers 3.
Right.
Very acronym rich.
So that when we get into these discussions, we can simply flip-flop. Oh, yeah, now I remember what that was.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when we're getting further into this, we can absolutely.
I know
that
it's
ready
all
for you.
Pretty common to most of you around the table here.
Maybe we can do a glossary guide that we can keep in the binders, like an acronym guide, and just everyone can help populate on a Google Doc.
With pictures, maybe.
Yeah, pictures, absolutely. And for me, I'm interested to know really what's best of class or what really is leading edge. And I know that's a debate, but ultimately data hopefully will help inform us and we refine over time.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask, I'm just curious, what did Arkansas find about the relationship between the classes?
So, essentially there are certain domains feel free to jump in. I have not worked with this as closely as Emma and Jessica have. There are certain domains of class where it's looking at certain aspects of instruction and classroom dynamic, and certain domains of Eckers, and it's looking at its own domains, and there's certain of those that overlap better than others, essentially. So there's
so the classroom 10 dimensions, it's really focused on teacher interaction rather than the materials in the classroom. And then I actually this week went and did our first one, and it was funny because she was talking about materials after, and I was like, I didn't even look at those because that's not what I'm looking at now. Eckers 3 has like 35 indicators. Some of those are teachers' interactions, but a lot of those are based on like the classroom physical setup, as well as the materials that are in the classroom. And so they've done some research that certain dimensions of the class, not even the class as a whole, but certain dimensions are really highly correlated to student outcomes. So, as we look at both, we're kind of looking at, can we continue, we choose to go with the class, can we use the class and still feel comfortable comparing it with the Eckers as programs are scored with one or the other, or are there certain things in each one that are really those indicators that are tied to those outcomes, and do we kind of just focus on those when we go into observation? So we're still very much in the beginning phases, and so as we get the data from the classes where we're doing it simultaneously, we'll be able to get a better picture.
A
was just going to ask, and when you said dimensions, do you mean like the dimension of the data, or do you mean like actual?
No, they call it's kind of like domains, but they call them dimensions. And so they have three. I'm checking my book here, so I'm still fairly new to it. But they have three different ones. So some of them are like teacher sensitivity. So are they aware of kids? Some of them are like the behavior productivity. So are the kids like busy? So the whole time, even if they'll. I feel like the teacher sits them in front of a movie, they'll get a high score on productivity because there was something for the kids to do. So just kind of really avoiding that wait time, quality of feedback. So just kind of the different dimensions of teacher interactions, really. So whereas like Eckers has 35 indicators, in comparison to class, it's 10 dimensions.
Do you have any dimensions over there? It's just 10.
It's
total,
just 10 dimensions, 10 and then they do stuff. They put them into three. Categories. Yeah, those right. Three go in, those 10 go into three categories.
Is it measured in the same time frame? Like
no, not at all. That's kind of the reason that we're kind of leaning towards the class is we haven't felt comfortable from the beginning with our data correlation. In the past, what we've been doing is we have an LEA that has 30 classrooms, and we'll go and do two observations in two classrooms and do the entire program high quality. And then when we do data evaluation, they're pulling kids from all of the 30 classrooms and kind of getting them the high quality staff, even though we haven't been there. That's never felt good to us. So we need, but the problem is we don't have the staff or the time to go and do 3-hour Eckers in 20 classrooms times 11 LEAs. So the class, in comparison to the Eckers 3-hour observation, you do it in 20-minute cycles. And the minimum you can do is 2 cycles, so that would be 40 minutes in the classroom. Compared to the 3 hours, and then like four, they say kind of four for kind of high stakes things. That's the best amount of cycles. I went to the training in Portland, and I'm going to work with and communicate with someone from Teachstone about our specific issue here in Utah, and that's the main reason we're interested in it is that it takes less time, and how they feel about how many cycles is reliable to do that.
Another follow-up question to that. So it sounds like then the class is kind of like binary, right? So like whether or not like the behavior is exhibited or not, is that correct? Or is there like a spectrum of?
So each indicator has like different elements in it, and then you go through and you kind of rate if they were in the low range for that, the mid range, or the high range.
Okay, so
there's each little So for teacher sensitivity, there's like 4 bullets under that, and then for each of those 4 bullets, you're like, was that in a low, medium, or high range?
Okay.
And then the combination of those scores equals the number that you give it. Next time I can bring like the actual things you can see. So, yeah.
Having knowledge in both, though, and going back to what you're measuring, are you measuring the quality of the program? If you're measuring the quality of the program, then the Eckers is a better tool to use, even though it's because you're actually looking at the environment, and environments really do make a big difference.
Yeah, the environments do make a big difference. I think the big thing, too, is for us to consider moving forward is what truly correlates to student outcomes. And that might be teacher interaction, and not necessarily, it is, but, like, what does our focus want to be? So, you know, are we focusing on that high-quality instruction and what's leading? Because I was talking to him about this, because we were comparing the tools as we were driving back. You know, you could have a classroom with very little materials and an amazing teacher and have great outcomes, and have a classroom with amazing materials and a crappy teacher and really poor outcomes. So it's just something for us to keep in mind. I agree, because it really doesn't look at the materials at all. But that's why we're going to kind of correlate look at the two on what, and it might end up being we're looking at a couple indicators from Eckers 3 and we're looking at a couple indicators from class, and that combination really gets us to that element. So this really is just that we're at the very base, the very beginning, and kind of analyzing that data and getting, like, my knowledge of class is a couple months old, so we're right. Very fresh.
And well, I think it's also really important to keep in mind that the cost of the amount of time that it takes to do Eckers 3. I mean, we don't. If you're only looking at 2 classrooms in a 30 classroom district, that's telling us nothing. Mm-hmm. And so we really need to think about this also in a practical sense. In terms of being able to get the statistical significance to the data that's collected.
That's true, but I've always been doing that quality person.
Yeah, but I think, and Mark, I would defer to you, but, you know, my reading of the literature is that the class, particularly the instructional support domain, is extremely reliable and actually has the highest correlation.
It is. You are correct. Yeah.
And I don't think
we're skipping on the tool so much.
The environment is the bothers me. Yeah. Does that make the big difference in development of children and how they see their outcomes?
And I don't want to imply, so my brevity and this last slide imply that we've sort of settled on this. That is part of the task of this subcommittee. Right, and absolutely. So, yeah, we're definitely going to take these concerns back. That's part of why we're reporting to you. So we're going to develop a recommendation. We're kind of early days of that. It seems like Class and Eckers 3 are kind of the big kids in the room as far as evaluation tools go. So, you know, those are the ones we're looking at. But yeah, I don't want to imply to the board that we've settled on this, and this is what we're doing. So, yeah.
The only thing I would add in just briefly is that you've got to look at the nature of the programs as well as what's going on, as well as what tool we're going to use. For the most part, the independent programs that are privately owned, they're day-long experiences for kids. Most of the school district programs are 2.5 hours, 2 to 2.5 hours. They're not full. Kids aren't there all day. The purpose of the program is very different than if I was sending my child to child care for the day.
And just want to add, too, for the class, I use class before, too. I think one thing I remember was Eckers. I don't want to say this, but there's some schools that can put these toys out for that observation and never use them. While the class, if you're doing an instruction, it's going to happen all the time.
Are these both announced type?
Yeah, I was going to say, usually
or are they
announced? Yeah, they're not announced.
Well, not announced, and if students have materials in there. Yeah, and if teachers are putting out materials that students haven't used, then oftentimes you know.
Well,
you
learn it out.
And the kids are like, hey, I've never used these before. So,
I mean, don't know how to use them.
I'm just going to say this is a really good example of how this committee works. See this today, and I think
these are contentious issues.
Well, I like the constructive tension, and I'll be looking forward to the recommendation. I think the issues are really important and what we'd hope that you'd focus on.
Hey, at least we're not trying to play with four. Just two.
We look forward to, you know, your findings and recommendations in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We were going to do a people review, but I don't think we have time today, Jessica, so maybe we'll pick that up in our next meeting. And I want to be respectful of time. I think we're at the hour. And I want to open this up at this point for public comments. It doesn't sound like there are any, so I'll entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right, thank you.